Well, we're on our way to the spiritual world. From Brahmaloka, through the coverings of the universe, dissolving the false ego, Haribo, and heading for the spiritual sky and on our way to Krishna Loka. Again, there's some description here about the subtle parts of this meditation process that are beyond our scope to clearly understand, and Prabhupada doesn't give elaborate purport, so we'll just cover the idea here. In the Sanskrit, the word is yogi. In the word for word, it's the devotee. So, the devotee surpasses the subtle objects of different senses. So these are, it's part of the 24, the Sankhya system. There's the objects of the senses, and there's the senses. So the idea is withdrawing. There was some question about what is contaminated consciousness. So when you withdraw consciousness, he seems to be in one of those moods tonight, so be ready to... When you withdraw consciousness, like Bhishma Dev withdrew consciousness, he withdrew his senses. So you can extend your senses, like the tortoise, for purpose of service, or one can, the yogi can, withdraw his senses. So that's what's being discussed here. The devotee surpasses the subtle objects of different senses, amalgamating the senses, withdrawing the senses from the sense objects. Now the sense objects still exist. The senses still exist. And when there's engagement with these senses and the sense objects, generally it's for kami, it's for sense gratification. But it can also be for bhakti. If you can recall in the purport of the last verse of the sixth chapter, where Krishna describes what is the topmost form of yoga. Who knows that verse besides Krishna Das? Last verse of the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Yogi Nam is how it starts. Yogi Nam. Go ahead. Okay. Shradhavan bhajate yomam. Bhaj. In the purport, Prabhupada explains, bhaj is the root word for bhakti. The implication of the word bhaj is practical activity, meaning the senses are engaged with sense objects. Now, a good part of what the yoga system is withdrawing the senses from sense objects. That's the pratyahara stage. Yama, yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, and the fifth one is pratyahara, withdrawing the senses from the sense objects. Ceasing activity, like reducing oneself, one's consolidation of consciousness into a neutral state. That's part of what the yoga process is. It's 1/8 of it. Then consolidation of the mind in stages, dhyana, dharana, and samadhi. So, sense objects, like the sense of smell and aroma, etc. So sense gratification is smelling something nice, feeling something nice, hearing something nice, so forth. Bringing the senses in contact with objects. Yoga is the neutral state, and bhakti yoga is the transcendental state. Actually, they're both in the transcendental state, but one is the neutral transcendental state, and the other is the relationship with Krishna. Transcendental state. Because if not for service for Krishna, the senses are dormant. For service for Krishna, the senses are extended. Prabhupada once described that if you offer to an impersonalist some gold, their hand will immediately, involuntarily go behind their back. But if you offer a devotee gold, involuntarily his hand for Krishna, not for oneself. The devotee thus surpasses the subtle objects. Now this is the subtle objects. There's subtle senses and the gross senses. There's the gross object and the subtle object. We'll make the distinction here. Just like the ear is the gross object or the sense. And if the ear is damaged, then you lose your hearing. Eardrum is damaged, you lose your hearing. But there are ways to, like a machine part, you put a hearing aid or have some kind of an operation where the instrument is replaced and then the hearing is restored, because the hearing capacity is within, in a subtle capacity. Or walking, you can lose a limb, but then you could put on a false limb and walk with a false limb, or use a wheelchair and move, because locomotion is a capacity that the body has, and the capacity can come out this way or that way or that way or this way or that way. So just like a machine part, your alternator goes bad, you put in another alternator. The heart goes bad, you put in another heart. There's the machine parts. The body is a machine. So there's the gross sense, and then there's the subtle sense. The sense of hearing is the subtle sense, and the ear is the instrument, the gross object. Similarly, there's subtle, the object of the sense. There's the good and the bad smells, the original fragrance of the earth. Here, it's the discussion is that the devotee surpasses the subtle objects. It's not identified in the Sanskrit, subtle objects, but in any case, the subtle objects of different senses, like aroma by smelling, the palate by tasting, vision by seeing forms, touch by contacting, the vibrations of the ear by ethereal identification or sound, and the sense organs by material activities. So this is, it's like pratyahara. The purport: beyond the sky there are subtle coverings resembling the elementary coverings of the universes. The gross coverings are a development of partial ingredients of the subtle causes. What was that? The gross coverings are the development of partial ingredients of subtle causes. What that means is, in the third canto of the Bhagavatam, the process of creation is described as an unfolding. From subtle, gross elements unfold. And then from that gross element, the next more gross element unfolds and unfolds and unfolds and unfolds and unfolds. The first most subtle element that manifests is false ego. The most subtle. You go earth, water, fire, air, sky, mind, intelligence, false ego. So from the false ego, the other elements, mind, intelligence, earth, water, fire, air, ether. And even the earth, water, fire, ether is in the reverse order. Ether comes first, then air, then fire, then water, then earth. So that's the idea that the grosser manifestations come from the subtler composition. Is that clear? Like, for example, Prabhupada explains this, that ether carries sound, right? Ether carries sound. So that means, since ether is the most subtle, then sound is also carried in water, and air in water, in fire, and in earth. You know, there's ether within because it's more subtle. It's ether that carries the sound, but sound is also carried in earth and in water. Those of you that have spent time in water swimming, I have. You can hear when a boat is passing by, you can hear it, or some rocks clash with one another, you can hear. It's carried in the water. Because there's the element of ether within water. There's the element of ether within air, within fire. And when you take away all the other elements, still sound carries because it's carried through ether. You with me? Science 101. So that's what's being said here. The gross coverings are a development of partial ingredients of the subtle causes. Okay? So, the yogi or devotee, along with liquidation of the gross elements, like, you know, they're withdrawn. The earth is withdrawn into water. Into water. Water is withdrawn into fire. Fire is withdrawn into air. Air. It's collapsing backwards. As it unfolded, it collapses. So, the yogi or devotee, along with liquidation of the gross elements, relinquishes the subtle causes also. It's like, no longer identifying with the body and no longer identifying with the subtle objects of the senses. No longer identifying with the subtle elements that cause those grosser elements. Subtle causes like aroma by smelling, or sound by hearing, like that. The object is perceived by the sense of perception. The object is dissolved, and the sense of perception is also amalgamated into the original seat of consciousness, the soul. The pure spiritual spark, the living entity, thus becomes completely cleansed of all material contamination to become eligible for entrance into the kingdom of God. End of purport. Short purport. So it's a technical procedure that in previous ages, yogis were very expert in knowing step by step by step by step by step to reach the stage of going back to Godhead by complete detachment from matter. As I mentioned, this principle of detachment is a principle in these two chapters. It's a principle of spiritual life. How can you have attachment to spirit without detachment from matter? Remember, how can you take another object while you're still holding on to some object? You have to let go. Then you can... One holds on to a material conception of life. How are you going to advance in spiritual life? You can call it troublesome. Or you can call it, it isn't going to happen. Struggle. Okay. But this devotee isn't attached, he keeps going. The devotee, thus surpassing the gross and subtle forms of coverings, enters the most subtle, the plane of egoism. And in that status, he merges the material modes of nature, that is, ignorance and passion, in this point of neutralization, and thus reaches egotism in goodness. Now, those of you that have a sharp memory, or else have studied the third canto of the Bhagavatam, when egotism, which is the first of the 24 elements that separates after the glance of Mahavishnu, again, when egotism comes in contact with goodness, which element manifests next? The mind. So one might wonder, sometimes it's been wondered, why the mind, why not intelligence? It seems like intelligence should be more subtle. It is more subtle. Why is it not the mode of goodness manifests the intelligence? Well, it'll be discussed indirectly here, but it's the mind that needs to be placed on Krishna in the meditation process, in the bhakti process. Manmana. Because this is the state of goodness. In passion, the material intelligence is necessary. Oh, those of you who are going to school and getting groomed to develop your material intelligence, this is an essential asset for passion. Because the intelligence becomes, in the upside-down fashion of material life, the intelligence becomes the servant of the dictates of the mind. Here's how it works. The senses actually dictate to the mind. And the mind dictates to the intelligence. It's totally upside down. The senses experience an object out there. That impulse goes from the sense organ of perception to the mind. Ooh, there's that object. But the mind can't acquire the object without the assistance of the intelligence. So, my dear intelligence, could you please come here a moment? Yes, sir. What can I do for you, sir? Well, you're a very good servant. I'm sure you can figure out how to acquire that object of the sense out there. Can you do that? Yes, I can do that. I have to go to school for five years. But when I go to school for 5 years, I'll surely figure out how to get that object of the sense for you. And then your sense can be satisfied, and then you'll be satisfied, and I'll be in good service. The service of the master of the mind, which is dictated to by the demands of the senses. Passion is the material, rules the material intelligence, where the mind is screaming, I want to enjoy. And the senses are dictating, enjoy this way, enjoy this way, enjoy this way. And all five of them are simultaneously demanding satisfaction. So that's not the mode of goodness. But when one goes in the reverse direction, then the mode of goodness becomes the pursuit, and then from that position of goodness, entering into transcendence. So again, in this point of neutralization, the yogi merges the material modes of nature in that point of neutralization, and thus reaches egotism in goodness. After this, all egoism is merged in the Mahatattva. That's the end of egoism for the yogi. And he comes to the point of pure self-realization. Now Prabhupada, as in a very consistent manner, is explaining or defining self-realization. Simple self-realization definition. It's the pure consciousness of admitting oneself to be an eternal servant of Krishna. Who am I? Ke ami, in Sanatana Goswami's submission to Lord Chaitanya. Who am I? So one answer of who am I is Aham Brahmasmi. But that's an incomplete understanding, because what does Brahman do? What do souls do? Souls do something. And that something that they do is that they serve the Supreme Soul. So self-realization is to realize that I'm the eternal servant of Krishna. Accepting that position is self-realization. So our system is direct. We try to serve Krishna, and we hear the message of Krishna from Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, so we can become, our intelligence can become purified and take its rightful position of directing the mind. My dear mind, please don't go over into the rubbish pile of sense gratification. Come over here instead. Go to Krishna. The intelligence directs the mind, and then the mind directs the senses. My dear eyes, don't go over there. Go over here. My dear ear, don't listen to that sound vibration. Listen to this one. So it's the intelligence giving direction to the mind that gives direction to the senses. Then things are in proper order. So our process is direct. This yogic process is neutral. Here's how Prabhupada explains it. It is suggested herein that the process of purifying the senses is by the yogic way, namely, again, it's a little technical, the gross senses are merged. To where do the gross senses come from? Egotism in the mode of ignorance. Gross senses are merged into the mode of ignorance. The subtle senses, intelligence, merge into the mode of passion. The mind belongs to the mode of goodness and is therefore called Devamaya or godly. Perfect purification of the mind is made possible when one is fixed in the conviction of being the eternal servitor of the Lord. That's self-realization. When the mind can take hold of the conception of what the soul really is, that's self-realization. Eternal servant of Krishna. Then it's not just accepting on the platform of the mind. If one engages in that conception, that's yoga. One is linked with Krishna. Therefore, simple attainment of goodness is also a material mode. One has to surpass this stage of material goodness and reach the point of purified goodness. Vasudev Sattva helps one to enter into the kingdom of God. That means you have to apply that conception. Jnanam Vijnanam Astakyam Brahma Karma Svabhavajam. So then, that's the process, and the process can be approached by the meditation yoga system or by the bhakti yoga system. Prabhupada explains what we've heard so many times. In this age of Kali, this meditation or dhyan yoga process is not going to be effective. We don't have the capacity to live for 40,000 years, 100,000 years. We don't have the duration of life. We don't have the disposition. We don't have the temperament. We don't have the capacity to perfect this yoga system. Although Dhruva, he perfected this system in 6 months. But that was Satya Yuga, and look what he did in 6 months. Do we have that capacity? So if that's so, why was this being introduced into the Srimad Bhagavatam? Prabhupada answers that because in the Yuga, when this, just before this was spoken, or the forefathers of Maharaj Parikshit, everybody knew this system. I explained that. The Pandavas, they knew, and Bhishma Dev knew, and Dhritarashtra knew, and they were all trained up. They had qualified Brahmana teachers since childhood, and they were trained. They knew how to do the system. So then, next, Lord Chaitanya has come to deliver a very, very simple system. The same principles are fulfilled, but the process is very simple. Now he explains, ultimately the result is non-different. If you can remember back to chapter 19, I believe it's in chapter 19, the end of 18 and the beginning of 19, when Maharaj Parikshit has his encounter with Shamik Rishi. And Prabhupada explains, the Rishi was a yogi, and Maharaj Parikshit was a bhakta, and they were on the same platform. We call that section? Same platform, transcendentalists. Their approach was different, the platform they reached was the same platform. And they had great respect for one another. They weren't thinking, oh, he's just a yogi. Or the yogi wasn't thinking, oh, he's just a sentimentalist bhakta. They were transcendentalists on the same spiritual platform. And they exhibited qualities commensurate with their realization. They're both very, very elevated souls. So Prabhupada writes, ultimately there is no difference in the result. The first and foremost point one must understand is the prime importance of bhakti yoga. The living beings and different species of life are undergoing different terms of encagements according to their fruitive actions and reactions. But in the execution of different activities, one who secures some resources in bhakti yoga can understand the importance of service to the Lord through the causeless mercy of the Lord as well as that of the spiritual master. Now this is the process recommended for this age in the revealed scriptures, and therefore the qualified spiritual master will teach primarily this bhakti yoga process, because that's the process. Yoginam api sarvesham bhagvaten antaratmanam shradhavan bhajate yamam same yukta uttama mataha. Even if the dhyan process is introduced, bhakti is the operative, powerful principle behind it. And a qualified teacher or spiritual master will make sure that the student understands that. Even if they're taught dhyan, they understand really the goal is devotion to the Supreme. So then Prabhupada explains how the spiritual master, or the importance of the spiritual master's role in this whole process. The spiritual master specifically sows the seed of bhakti. Who knows the verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita? Brahmanda brahmete kona bhagyavan jeev Guru Krishna Prasadi Vai Bhakti Lata Beach. You want to recite it? Brahmanda? Okay. Krishna Archana, you know this verse? She should learn it. Brahmanda means the universe. Brahmanda brahmite kona bhagyavan. Jeev. There's Bhagavan and there's Bhagyavan. Krishna, he's Bhagavan. And one who receives the mercy of Bhagavan is Bhagyavan. Jeev. Guru Krishna Prasade Bhai. By the mercy of Guru and Krishna, Bhakti Lata Bij. One receives the seed of the creeper of devotion. Brahmanda brahmite kona bhagyavan jeev. Guru Krishna prasad. Sometimes Prabhupada says kripai bhai, prasade bhai. Same, mercy. By the mercy of the spiritual master and Krishna, both, one receives the bhakti lata bij. So, the spiritual master introduces one to the process of devotional service and supplies the means of nurturing that creeper. What is the nurturing process? Hearing and chanting. And very important, Prabhupada says the hearing and chanting is not just the mantra. Spiritual master gives the mantra, but the spiritual master also gives the message of Bhagavad Gita as it is, and Srimad Bhagavatam, so that the means of purifying the heart is there, and the proper direction of how to conduct your life in Krishna consciousness is there. The intelligence is purified, and the mind is purified, both. So then you can proceed nicely. One without the other is insufficient. Even Haridas Thakur says, in order to achieve the full benefit of chanting the holy name, one must have proper sambandha gyan. Sambandha gyan means knowledge of the relationship. Sambandha. Sambandha. Knowledge of the relationship of all things with Krishna. Basically, you have your map and you know what's what. You know how to get from where you are to where you want to go. You're fortified with proper knowledge how to apply the science of devotional service in your life and the means of purifying the heart or cleansing the mind. Cheta, darpana, marjanam. Both are supplied. Lord Chaitanya encouraged everyone to chant. Lord Chaitanya also taught process of devotional service from Srimad Bhagavatam. So in this chanting process, there's three stages, he mentions. We know what those three stages are, right? Beginning, middle, and end. Or the offensive, the clearing stage, and the offenseless stage. And here he calls this middle stage the stage of reflection. Stage of reflection in Sanskrit is abhas. So nam aparad on this side, shuddha nam on this side, in the middle is abhas, nam abhas. Abhas means shadow, or it can also mean reflection. Just like seeing the light of the moon is the reflection of the light of the sun. And the reflection of the light of the sun upon the moon is not as bright as the sun. It's light, but it's not direct sunlight, it's indirect sunlight, because it's just a reflection. Or those of you that like science, you know what is the difference, who's taking the science class and knows what umbra and penumbra is? You've learned that in science? You've learned. Any of the kids know what that is yet? You have an idea? You heard the terms before? Yes. So they'd make this little drawing where there's the big sun over here, and then there's the earth over there, and then there's like this cone effect where the sun is, the rays of the sun are blocked behind the earth, so it's dark. But then there's another cone that goes out the other way where some indirect rays of the sun are visible. That's like where it's dawn or dusk. It's not, you're not seeing the direct light of the sun, but you're seeing some sunlight. And then when that closes, then you can't see even the indirect light of the sun. Dusk ends in its darkness. Or the morning before the sun rises, at night it's dark, and then there's dawn, and then you can see, boop, there's the sun on the horizon, direct sunlight. So that indirect light of the sun is abhas, a reflection, not direct, indirect. So the chanting of the holy name that we're doing, pretty much, is that abhas chanting. So it's stated here, as is stated elsewhere in our scriptures, in that abhas stage of chanting, liberation from all the reactions of sins can be achieved. Now we'll compare that to what we just read a few verses ago in the second canto, chapter 2, where the yogi, he has to go through this vaihayasa region, the planet of the fire god, where he gets this same effect that we get from abhas chanting. We don't have to go in this like zoom, zoom, zooming around, and which planet is that? Bahayas, a planet anyways, and go there and enter into the fire and get freed from our reactions of sins. We just chant Hare Krishna. Play Mridanga, cartels, chant Hare Krishna. The effect is there. That's just in the abhas stage, or this middle, intermediate stage. But we don't want to stop at the intermediate stage any more than the yogi should stop in the vahayasa planet and just hang out there. He goes on. He goes on to Brahmaloka, and then goes on to through the coverings of the universe. So we want to go on. And our way of going on is by offenseless chanting. improving the quality of our chanting beyond the Abhas stage to the Shuddha stage. That's how we do it. And what really helps to do that is that you have a clear sense of the goal. I want my relationship with Krishna. Or this process of self-realization language that Prabhupada uses, as we have several times discussed, is the pure consciousness of admitting oneself to be the eternal servant of the Lord. This is the Vasudeva Sattva stage. It's really simple, except we're stubborn and lazy, misguided, unfortunate, and always disturbed. But it's really simple. As we're chanting, we should pray to Krishna that this innate desire to enter fully into our relationship with Him awakens in our heart. And of course, that we get enormous help from the spiritual master, as indicated in Prabhupada's purport. And then this bhakti lata continues to grow, and as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describes, it pierces the coverings of the universe just like the yogi does. We just hang on to this bhakti lata, and it goes through the coverings of the universe, goes into the spiritual sky, reposes itself on Krishna Loka, and the fruits and flowers fall at the feet of Krishna. And there we are, just from this bhakti lata bij that we receive from the spiritual master and carefully nurture it by his guidance and training. Then Prabhupada writes, but there's always a but, right? Some condition. The working devotee must always be mindful so that the creeper, which has so grown, will not be cut off. Therefore, we should be mindful of the following considerations. He doesn't give the eight, doesn't give the 10 offenses. He gives another interesting list of 8 things, and we'll read the 8 things and have some discussion. 1. Offense by one at the feet of a pure devotee may be likened to the mad elephant who devastates a very good garden if it enters. So, sadhuninda. 2. One must be very careful to guard himself against such offenses at the feet of pure devotees, just as one protects a creeper by all-around fencing. That's still sadhuninda. You avoid it and you protect against it. It's the 2 statements. 3. If it so happens that by the watering process some weeds are also grown. Any of you that have done some gardening or even just taking care of tulsi and you water, put water in the garden and the thing you want to grow is nourished, and all the other seeds that are in the soil also grow. And which grows faster, the weeds or the things that you want to grow? The weeds grow so fast. And they take all the water and they take all the sunlight, and if you just let them grow, the next thing you know, you have a garden of weeds. Chanting works the same way. There's things in the heart. And if you're not vigilant, you chant and impure desires also get nourished from chanting. So one has to vigilantly extract the weeds from the garden of the heart. That's what's the 3rd item that's mentioned here. Unless such weeds are uprooted, the nurturing of the main creeper, or the creeper of bhakti yoga, may be hampered. 4. Actually, these weeds are material enjoyment, option number one, merging of the self and the absolute without separate individuality. Number two and three. Many other desires in the field of religion, economic development, sense gratification, and liberation. So one should vigilantly guard against those types of desires. Number five, there are many other weeds, like disobedience to the tenets, T-E-N-E-T-S, like the injunctions, the rules, tenets of the revealed scriptures. It's just, you do things you shouldn't do. Or unnecessary engagements, wasting time, frivolous activity, prajalpa, or even worse, speaking offensive things to others or about others, killing animals, hankering after material gain, prestige, and adoration. Six, this is all on the same point. This is like how to improve your chanting. If sufficient care is not taken, then a watering process may only help to breed the weeds, stunting the healthy growth of the main creeper, and thus resulting in no fructification of the ultimate requirement, love of God. What a shame. Seven, therefore, the devotee must be very careful to uproot the different weeds in the very beginning. Only then would the healthy growth of the main creeper not be stunted. And finally, eight, by so doing, the devotee is able to relish the fruit of love of God and thus live practically with Lord Krishna, even in this life, and be able to see the Lord in every step. We're not there yet, because we didn't do the first seven things. So we have to go back and do a little review, make sure we're guarding against offenses, avoiding it, guarding against it, and uprooting the weeds that grow along with the creeper of devotion whenever chanting the holy name. So the process is easy, vigilance also has to be there. And the purport ends, the highest perfection of life is to enjoy life constantly in the association of the Lord. That's our relationship with Krishna, and that means serving Him. And one who can relish this does not aspire after any temporary enjoyment of the material world via other media. In other words, the withdrawing of the senses from the objects of the senses and all those mechanical things that the yogi has to, like, okay, what about that sense? What about that sense? Just, it's automatically taken care of by coming to the conclusion of attraction for serving Krishna in a selfless way. Okay, so nice subject, huh? Very interesting way to approach it. Talking about yoga, next thing you know, we're in the spiritual world. Any discussion? Okay. Microphone.
Maharaj, you mentioned two things for us to make progress. One is understanding Samadhyayana properly and chanting the holy name properly. So in my own personal practice, I find that there is a lot of emphasis on Samadhyayana, understanding from studying the scripture, from relating with the spiritual preceptors, and there is a lot of emphasis in that area. But chanting, I personally don't see Now, is there something wrong that I am doing, or is it something which grows in natural course? I don't understand how.
I don't know if it's something necessarily wrong that you're doing. It may have something to do with how the process of Krishna consciousness is. We're more easily attracted to one than to the other. Because the mind is restless. Very, very difficult to focus the mind. And so the other is easier. And so that's just because it's easier, we're more prone to do that. We have plenty of opportunity every day with chanting, isn't it? Not only our japa and kirtan, but both are required. So if you've recognized the importance of giving more attention, so give more attention. It's not even a matter of how much time you spend, it's the quality with which and the effort with which you apply yourself in chanting, isn't it? Sachinandan Swami from Germany likes the topic of chanting very much. He's written a whole book about just like explaining Harinam Chintamani by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and he gives seminars on it. I know one devotee from America, well actually he's of Indian origin, but he's doing his PhD in America. His PhD work took him to Switzerland for some work for his PhD project. So while there, he had the opportunity to participate in a 1-week retreat with Sachinandan Swami. So what they did was, they're like 20 people, and they went way up into the Alps for a 1-week retreat on chanting. The first day was talking about chanting, Sambandh again. The second day was a vow of silence, chant 64 rounds in the mountains of Switzerland. The third day was, what was the experience like? The fourth day was 64 rounds and a vow of silence. Go more deeply. And I don't know what the last 3 days were. But it's something that a serious devotee takes very seriously. Because our process is chanting. It's not, I mean, it's combined with the knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam. But even Srimad Bhagavatam is to name, fame, pastimes of the personality of God and preparing us for entering into those with proper orientation, with proper conceptions. But the chanting, that's the fuel. And the other guides. Intelligence is meant to guide. The mind is meant to be fixed upon Krishna, and the most effective means is the chanting process. So, it's more challenging. But as one advances, it becomes a more and more and more and more, increasingly more important subject. At our GBC meeting, we had so many important things to discuss, but one segment of time was Shivaram Maharaj was given an hour and a half to just present from Nectar Devotion, what does one meditate upon when chanting the holy name? An hour and a half. And that's Sambandha. We didn't experience it, but it was explaining the theme of it was there's stages of devotion and there's stages of chanting. And depending upon one stage of devotion, there's stages of absorption and chanting. And for us, the short of it is, for us, where our attention should be reposed while chanting is on the sound of Krishna's holy name. But Chanchala, Himana Krishna, ha. Mind is so flickering. Very difficult to curb it and control it. But that's so. The other's easier. The other's harder. But advancement requires putting very serious effort into chanting when chanting. Or to hearing when chanting the holy name. Okay, anything else?
Maharaj, from morning class, one reference that it was said that when a yogi, accomplished yogi, reaches spiritual world, he gets a four-handed form. When an accomplished yogi reaches spiritual world, he attains four-handed form as a lord. So my question is that the spiritual form is fixed, then what is the understanding that how to get a four-handed form?
Since the spiritual form is fixed, how are we to understand that the perfected yogi gets a four-handed form? That's your question?
Yes.
Why not? I don't understand your question. What's is there some rule restricting that from happening?
Means we. It is mind. What I understood is that what my understanding is that spiritual form means whatever is the spiritual form that is. If one is whatever is the spiritual form that is fixed, then how we get a four-handed form?
Why not? You repeated your question, and I have the same blank. Why does the spiritual form have to be something other than four-handed? Is there an obstacle or a contradiction? Because we have a two-handed form, therefore this liberated, the perfected yogi has to have a two-handed form? I don't get it.
Anybody can have any form in the spiritual world. He may be it is said it can be a flower or it can be anything.
That's indicating... Aha, okay. Well, I'm reluctant to go too much into Brihat Bhagavatamrita, but Brihat Bhagavatamrita explains, I'll go a little bit there, it explains that yes, there are forms that are four-handed, and there are forms that are all the varieties of existence in the spiritual world, because all the varieties of existence of the spiritual world is fully conscious and simply serving Krishna. I'll just keep it real simple, because to go into it too much detail gets a little overwhelming. The general position is the four-handed position, and there's so much variety. So rather than explaining the so much variety, the general position is described. The variety that's described in Brihat Bhagavatamrita would make your hair stand on end. So much variety. And it's depending on many variables, largely the variable being the modality of the worshipper. The position from which the worshipper began and entered into and became absorbed in the worship of Lord Narayan in Vaikuntha. Depending upon that position from which he did so and the modality of his worship, he may achieve so many different types of forms. But to keep it simple, forearm form. That's one of the four types of Vaishnava liberation, Sarupya Mukti, having a form like the Lord's. So therefore that Sarupya Mukti is spoken of. But there's others, Salokya, Sharsti, Samipya. Sarupya is primarily emphasized. Now your question makes, now I can understand why you're asking the question. Something? Yeah. Because of our desires, we empower Maya. No, she's empowered by Krishna, not by us. The action of Maya will come upon us according to our desires. You can say we energize Maya. That is, we indicate through our desire, we indicate to Maya, this is my weakness, and she feeds that weakness with the object of material attraction. Okay, so now your question is? Maya is? Inert? Maya is a person. She's very active. She's Krishna's servant. She considers her service to keep those people, keep those souls that are opposed to Krishna away from Krishna. She takes it as her service. She's very active. Now we can say material nature is inanimate. Prakriti is inanimate. It doesn't move except by the presence of soul that then moves it. That we can say. But Maya is Shakti, Tattva, conscious. Okay? Something else? Thank you. Is this from you? Okay. You want to write home? Can you please tell some practical steps on how to guard against the weeds in the heart while chanting? Is that right? It's G-A, is that guard? How to guard against? Huh? It's spelled wrong. G-U-A-R-D. Whoever wrote this one. How to guard against? Well, if you're going to grow a garden, you're going to anyone has cultivated a garden knows that you have to, when the little plant starts to grow, You have to know the difference between what the plant that you want to grow is, what the leaves of that plant look like, and what the leaves of another plant look like. Just like in the base of a tulsi plant. There's what a tulsi's leaves look like. It's very common. I mean, those that have taken care of tulsi, they know what those leaves look like. And the other jagged-edged ones or the other types of leaves that are the weeds, they don't look like the tulsi. You have to know what's the desired creeper and what's the unwanted creeper. You have to have some basic knowledge. Like Prabhupada was once asked, how do you know who is a bona fide spiritual master? And Prabhupada's answer was, there has to be some preliminary basic understanding. Just like if you go to the marketplace and want to buy a diamond. If you don't know what is a diamond, there'll be plenty of people who will want to cheat you. Oh my dear sir, let me sell you this very precious diamond. And it's plastic or glass. You have to have some fundamental understanding of what is a diamond. So what are some of the qualities of a diamond? The diamond will cut glass. One of our devotees was describing Tamal Krishna Maharaj had to go buy a watch in New York City. He grew up in New York City. So the person that was selling the watch at the counter said that the crystal in front of the watch wasn't glass, it was actual crystal. So Tamal Krishna took the crystal and placed it on the surface of the glass. And you said, are you sure? If I rub this hard against the glass, which is going to cut? The crystal or the glass on your tabletop counter? He started moving it. His disciple was with him and he was thinking, wow. My guru was street smart. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj was just watching the eyes of the merchant, knowing that if it was glass, not crystal, he'd start to freak out. And so he didn't continue. He just watched his eyes. And then he was confident it was crystal, not glass. He said, okay. So one has to, this is in a practical example, that one has to have some preliminary understanding of the subject. What is the creeper of bhakti? This is sambandhagyan. What is the creeper of bhakti? And what is the weeds of material contamination? And to guard against the weeds, you have to know what the real thing is, and you have to know what the other things are, what they look like. That's something preliminary. You have to know what's what. And then there also has to be a desire for the genuine thing. Some people are very contented with pride, adoration, and distinction. So there has to be, to guard against contamination, there has to be desire for the real thing. And one should take it for granted that in the beginning stage, there's a mix. So then you vigilantly look, there's this contaminated desire, let me remove it. One should be very eager to seek guidance, both in the department of distinguishing the real thing from the weed, and the determination to remove the weeds, taking strength from those who are wise and strong. Those are three very important parts of the chanting process. Anything else? Srila Prabhupada. He? Yeah.